I had 7 messages prepared for today because I already preached the Easter message some weeks ago. So I decided to do it again. In the shortest version I have ever done, and what in those 7 I prepared, you will have to suffer not hearing them. But what caused me to decide to do the same message again, and believe me, I know it's 2 minutes to 1, and this is not going to be as long as I normally take with the Easter message, but what caused me to decide to do it again was a couple of magazine articles that were delivered to me. There's a third one I don't have. U.S. News and World Report, Time Magazine, The Search for Jesus, U.S. News and World Report, In Search of Jesus. And that self-appointed band of scholars called the Jesus Seminar have finally made it big time. And in the news and in all television talk shows, we're back again to a group of scholars, self-proclaimed, questioning the most basic elements of the historic record about Jesus the Christ. I got all their books. This one by John Dominic Crossan, former Catholic priest, not anymore. Various other academics, including one leading movie producer. I guess that makes him a great Bible scholar. Even Cecil B. DeMille needed some help, because he had cripples coming out of Egypt. Remember that? And that famous movie that he did on the Ten Commandments, somebody should have told him that in the well-established Hebrew scriptures, probably less debated than any section of the Old Testament, the Psalms 105, says God brought them forth and there was not a feeble one in their midst. So, if Cecil B. DeMille needed a little help from a Bible scholar, probably the modern ones who produce movies, particularly when they do those like Showgirls, that doesn't give you much Bible research ability. Some other abilities, but not Bible research ability. I lost my faith in college with exactly this same thing. Academics who gave off an air you just couldn't really be wearing the wings of academic accomplishment or respected intelligence if you hung on to any of those mythological ideas of Jesus the Christ being the Son of God, or any miracles attached to Him. And they had proceeded to set up a standard to deal with marbles. They have red balls. I'm going to touch that. A couple other balls in between. And then they have black balls. And they have blackballed most of the gospel record. All of Matthew is eliminated. One verse in Mark is left. They have assembled a whole battery of records, and there are many records that you can go to for the New Testament story. I'm going to try to do this real quick. Matthew, Mark, Luke. They're called the Synoptic Gospels, because they, in essence, tell about the same story. Then John comes along with a lot of different added material that's not covered in the other two. Scholars now know that Matthew and Luke, when you can read the Greek, are quoting Mark. Mark was written first, when Matthew wrote his at Antioch, and Luke wrote his gospel. If you read the Greek, you can tell when the style changes, and Matthew and Luke are quoting Mark. But underneath all three of these, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, there is a body of sayings that's different in style to Mark's own personal style, which you can tell, Matthew and Luke's style. This body of sayings crops up in all three, different in style than any of the three, and it's given rise to the theory of the so-called Q document. First letter of the word meaning source in another language. And the Q document is isolated in the sayings in all three of the Gospels, suggesting that they had a common source. Mark had a common source. They had a common source behind that. You have the early church fathers. They preach sermons, just like I do. And they quote texts. And there are so many of the sermons assembled and found that you can almost put together from the assemblage of the preachers of the early church fathers, taking all of their texts, you can almost reassemble their source that they obviously were quoting back in the first and second centuries. You have early hymns of the church. And then you have more recent discoveries of the Gnostic Gospels of Nag Hammadi, which include all kinds of funny stuff, plus the so-called Gospel of Thomas that some have wanted to identify with the Q document, because all it consists of is sayings without too much illustration of events or historic narrative. Now the scholars are questioning that it's the Q document. It might also be using a common source. There are papyri that have been found. In fact, the best thing in this series of articles that just hit the news is the Magdalene papyri that is being traced by a very profound scholar to about 60 to 70 A.D., little fragments of Matthew's gospel that just blows to pieces the theory of some that it was written long after Matthew the Apostle had died. Sources abundant. And all these people have done is take all these sources, give them equal billing, like pieces of separate jigsaw puzzles, and they get a few little pieces and say, these are the only ones that we're going to accept as authentic, and we blackball all the rest, including taking Matthew out, taking all of Mark except one verse. And what they don't tell the world is they start out with a prejudice. They start out with an a priori frame of reference. Ipso facto, not to be debated, a given. You eliminate any reference to miracle. Therefore, if Jesus performed any miracles, or miracles were associated with him, though they lamely say they think he did heal some sick, if the reference has anything to do with miracle, blackball. Now, they meet once a year, and all these scholars sit around and they discuss the criteria of evaluation from all these sources that have been assembled, giving them all equal billing. If you've ever read, you don't even have to read it in the original, if you've ever read a translation of the Epistle of Barnabas alongside an Epistle of Paul, you will understand why the early church fathers rejected the so-called Epistle of Barnabas is a fraud. But these people treat them all the same. I mean, you get a treatise written by a convict on death row, you give it equal billing as a legal brief by one of the leading firms of constitutional lawyers. Each of them get equal billing, equal value. It's the way they're treating all the sources. And blackballing anything that has miracles attached. That's out. Second criteria of elimination any reference by Jesus or anyone else that he was Messiah, had Messiah tendencies, or fulfilled, or was viewed as fulfilling any Old Testament prophecy. Because they view that as interpretation. Therefore, any reference that makes Jesus look like he is representing himself as Messiah, or has the writer representing him as Messiah, or any reference to Jesus seeing himself, or someone else viewing him as fulfilling Old Testament prophecy, that's out, blackballed, as interpretation. For example, when Jesus goes into the synagogue and reads from Isaiah 60, and then stops in mid-sentence and says, "This day, this verse is fulfilled in your eyes," that's out. Because he's claiming to fulfill or be a party to a fulfillment of prophecy. Everyone, you've heard it on Good Friday, you know it's not Good Friday, but you've heard it. Every one of the sayings of Jesus on the cross, because they represent sayings, quotations of Scripture, might be interpreted as fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy. In short, Jesus, the greatest teacher of the Word alive, who confounded the Pharisees when he was 12 years old, if that record's any good, and throughout 2,000 years has been viewed as an interpreter of Scripture, he wasn't allowed to quote Scripture. If he quoted the Scripture, that's blackballed, not authentic, because that is conveying interpretation. That's why they end up with nothing in Matthew. Matthew wrote his gospel to prove that Jesus fulfilled the prophecies. So Matthew's out. Mark wrote his gospel to prove that Jesus was the suffering servant Messiah, prophesied in the book of Isaiah, that Messiahship image that most of the Pharisees had missed, who only looked for the Son of Man to come and set up his kingdom. That's why there's only one verse left in Mark. There's no Lord's Prayer. Because that separates Jesus from the others. He didn't pray the Lord's Prayer. He said, "When ye pray, say this." And I happened to go through the book this last week and read their assembled Bible. Of course, nothing new in this. One very creative person said, "Can't create anything new. The ancients have stolen everything new." Tom, we got Jefferson's Bible back there. Jefferson tried to do the same thing. He figured if he could isolate what he considered to be the pure sayings of Jesus, he would have the highest moral code alive. And he then did a cut and paste job. Marcion, the first great heretic, did that at about 140 A.D. Nothing new in this. It's just like a cycle. It goes around again and again. These people have now put together an emaciated list of sayings that they say are not blackballed. They're a red letter. They pass. And they're publishing a book so we can know what Jesus really said based on these guys voting with their marbles loose. Only problem is in the sayings, they just cut the sense out of things. For example, Jesus said, "If any man will come after me and hate not his father, his mother, his wife, his children, his brother, and his sisters, yea, and his own life also," Matthew puts it into preference. "If they come after me, they must prefer me to all these other claims." And then he tells a parable to illustrate the cost he's requiring of discipleship. He says, "Which of you intending to build a tower, sitteth not down first and counteth the cost of it, whether he have sufficient to finish it? Lest haply after he hath laid the foundation and is not able to complete it, all who behold it begin to mock him, saying, This man began to build and was not able to finish. Or which king," he says, "going to make war against another king, sitteth not down first and consulteth whether he be able with 10,000 to meet him that cometh against him with 20,000. Lest haply while the other is yet a great way off, he sendeth an ambassage desiring conditions of peace. This is a direct quote from Luke 14. Having given that illustration, don't start to build without counting the cost so you can finish. Don't go to war without estimating odds so you can win. He then says, so likewise, whosoever he be of you, that forsaketh not all that he hath, cannot be my disciple. They take everything out except the parable. Jesus said that, they say. Which of you intending to build, sitteth not down first, count the cost? Which of you going to war, doesn't send an ambassage, desiring conditions of peace, if you can't meet the one that comes against you with 10,000 because, or 20,000 because you only have 10? They leave that hanging in air. He said that, but he didn't say, if you come out to me, this is the cost, and I'm going to illustrate the cost, and now so likewise, whosoever be of you. They just tear apart that which is intrinsically connected. Now, having said that, my professors made me think I was a nut. And one professor whom I read for said, I read your papers, I chose you as my reader, I see your grades, I can't understand why you are retaining this faith in Jesus Christ as supernatural. And then he leans back, Lou Oliver, head of the history department at Chico State University, puts his hands on his rather ample stomach and said, I figured it out, Gene. It's okay. It's a vestigial remnant of emotional connection with your father. And I, therefore, he could put up with that defect and not be ashamed that my grades had made me the choice as his reader. And he wouldn't ever give in that it had to be an emotional, psychological defect to believe in Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And they offered in the place what these guys were offering. Jesus is a good and wise teacher. I haven't time today, but I'd love to take one of them on. Because late last night I read their whole new assembled Bible. And I marked in my Bible, I'm not sure you can see it, not marked in my Bible, marked alongside their quotations. You can get a camera on this. In Croson's book, they have assembled the verses that they didn't blackball. They're okay. You see this little mark in the margin? See this long line there? See this mark here in the margin? Throughout this, this mark in the margin, they just were not able to eliminate all of the sayings which contain within them claims that no mortal man has a right to make. Now, in exactly 4 minutes, I'm going to say what separated me from bondage to academics like this. I don't care where you go, I just marked the paragraphs in their newly reconstituted words of Jesus. Same in every source you take. Q document, John, Luke, Mark, Matthew, verses found in the preachments of the fathers, early hymns of the church. Don't care where you go. You've got to have a source for Jesus to say he's a good and wise teacher. Good thing said, description of good deeds done. Whatever source you use, you're going to find him making claims, and that's why I put the marks in the margins of this, which I wish I had an hour so I could read them all. Somewhere in his sayings and doings, he's going to make a claim about himself no mortal man has a right to make. He seated authority in himself. He didn't have an outside criteria. Academics would have you put Jesus on a platform with Muhammad, Gautama Buddha, Confucius, respected founders of world religions. They never made claims like Jesus made. Buddha had an objective criteria. He sought deliverance from what they call in their language, Tanya, thirst after the things of this life. He was a prince in India, raised his family, a clear historic figure. He then, when his family was raised, sought deliverance from the sense of thirst or Tanya, which was sin or falling short of the ideal. He tried the way of the sensualist, losing himself in pleasure, tried the way of the aesthetic, the yogi. Neither way worked. He came to what he called the middle path, the so-called eightfold path that brought a state of conscious or loss of consciousness, a trance-like state, where he lost any sense of identity with the things of this world. And when he came out of that state, postulated that the wheel of life, karma, had ceased. He only had to live out his karma. Then he'd become one with the that which is behind all that. They wouldn't even define it. Ultimate reality being nothingness that's undefined out there. And all he offered was his experience. Did it work for me? Try it, it'll work for you. An objective criteria for his authority. Muhammad claimed visions. Allah told me this in vision. Objective criteria. Old Testament prophets would say, the Lord says, claim a vision or a revelation. Authority external to themselves. Confucius made a logical analysis of society, said if people would try what he concluded were the right ways of intersocial relationship, problems of this world would be solved. They tried it in one city. It didn't work. He said they tried it wrong. But his criteria of authority was an outside logical, empirical analysis of the interplay of social relationships. All of them had outside criteria. Only Jesus seated authority in himself. You've heard it said unto you, quoting the ancient Pharisees, but behold, I say. Didn't give me criteria. I say it. You build on what I say, you build on a rock. You build on anything else, you build on sand. All authority in heaven and earth is given unto me. He forgave sins. That's why the Jews thought he blasphemed. Only God can forgive sin. Prophets never did that. They said, the Lord forgive you. He said, thy sins be forgiven. They bring a violator of the law, a woman taken in adultery. In the very act, they said, what are you going to do about it? He says, he that's without sin among you, let him first cast a stone. And they left with the stones dropping on the pavement. He then looked at her and forgave her. Neither do I condemn thee. Go and sin no more. He condemned the righteous of his day, didn't even blink. Said, you're like a grave painted white on the outside. Pretty on the outside to look at. Inside, you're full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. He thought he was perfect. He clearly accepted John's designation of him as the Lamb in a context of Hebrew theology where the Lamb had to be perfect without blemish. To forgive sin is to assume no sin. That's why we cannot judge. Judge not that you be not judged, for the measure you mete out will be meted to you. Only someone that is sinless can forgive sin. He never prayed the Lord's Prayer. That's why they don't like to leave it in. Buddha, he said his life meant nothing. His death meant nothing. He left the way that worked for him. They were to do what he did, their form of prayer. Jesus said, when ye pray, say this. John 17 has the Lord's Prayer. He says, Father, I completed the task. I did what you sent me to do. Now restore me to the glory I have. No sense of moral inadequacy. He spoke of the eternal world from the inside. Confucius said, don't ask me about the next life. I can't even solve problems this life. Muhammad had a vision. Jesus spoke of it as though he had personal experience there. I saw Satan cast down. Before Abraham I was. He put himself the center of the religious universe. He did not preach a doctrine apart from himself. Buddha preached the way. I repeat, he said, I don't mean anything. My death doesn't mean anything. We have in the tripart basket of scriptures from which all streams of Buddhism flow. His own message is saying he was nothing. All he left was the way. It worked for him. Try it. Confucius, he didn't offer himself. He offered that social formula that he had worked out. Muhammad. They don't want to be called Mohammedans. There's only one God, Allah. Muhammad's his prophet. He never offered himself. He offered the words of Allah, communicated by vision in the Quran. Jesus centered himself. I am the way, I am the door, I am the light. By me, if any man enter in, he shall be saved. I am the water of life. He that cometh after me, not my way, he that cometh after me. Follow me was his message, not follow my way. He put himself the total center of the religious universe. He said something's wrong with the whole world. It can only be set right by him being offered as a ransom. In a theological context of centuries of Hebrew thought, where the ransom was the price you paid to redeem a lost estate, to restore a lost inheritance, to save the life of an unclean animal destined to death if the ransom were not paid. He said his life poured out unto death, ransomed the world, and somehow put him back in good standing with God. And he said that when they killed him, he'd raise on the third day. Now, I don't care what the source, including these guys' source, even though they leave out miracle and any claims of messiahship, they still can't sever from their red-balled approved sayings claims like this. I spoke my regard for Patty Glaser. It knows no bounds. I probably should reverse the illustration. I think she has respect for me. But if, as she came with her husband today and her friends, if I stood on this platform and started out saying, all authority in heaven and earth is given unto me. You build on what I say? Rock. Build on anything else? Sand. Before Abraham was, I was. I was there when Satan was cast out. You want to go to heaven? Make me your master. I'm the center of the religious universe. I'm the door of the sheep cop. Go in any other way, you're a thief and a robber. You get in by following me. And the world's got something wrong with it. It can only be set right by me. I'm the only one worth enough to stand in the place of the traditional lamb of vicarious sacrifice throughout history. Patty would already be hitting the door calling a doctor. You don't make saints out of anybody making those kinds of ridiculous claims. That puts him in the category of Jimmy Jones, Father Divine, and the nuts of religious history. Not on the platform with respected founders. You can't call him good and wise. He can be good, but an idiot who believes the impossible about himself. There are lots of good idiots. Don't want to spend much time with them, but they're good. They're too dumb to know their problems. I married one once. All my various wives can try to figure out which one I'm talking about. You can be good and believe the impossible about yourself, but you can't be wise. Or you can be wise enough to deceive people into believing the impossible about you, but you're a fraud and a liar. You can't be good. Why did they call him good and wise when he made these ridiculous claims that no mortal man has a right to make? But if he came out of that tomb, believe you me, as I was going to use the illustration, Patty Glaser made those claims about herself. I'd wonder if our legal affairs are in good hands or not. But if Patty Glaser, who made those claims, said, I'm dying today, and 3 days later, 72 hours later, I'm coming out of the tomb, I'd take another look at her if she came out. God be a woman, awful sudden. Because it's the one who makes the claims, that's what makes it significant. Not just that he rose, but the one who went about making these claims, precluding him being called good and wise, and those who say he's a good and wise teacher and nothing else reveal their ignorance of what he said about himself. They don't pay attention to him. They don't know what he's talking about, including these jerks with their marbles loose. You can really be an academic nut. You ought to vote with nuts. There's an evil side to academics who tell you their conclusions without telling you the presuppositions before the conclusions came out. They have an aura of objective scholarship looking at everything, and this leaps out at us as the only thing that's original. Tell the world you've eliminated going out the gate any reference to miracle. Thus you've eliminated what Paul says is the basis of the Christian faith. For we have testified of him, God, that is, Paul said, that he raised up the Christ from the dead. 7 weeks after he was crucified, Peter stood down before the mob, below the upper room, said, this Jesus hath God raised up, whereof we all are witnesses. He stirred up the city, and day after day preaching, you killed the Prince of Life. Desired a murderer to be granted unto you. But God raised him up from the dead. And Paul said, if Christ be not risen, our faith is vain. For we've testified to God that he raised him up. Christianity is based on a fact. You don't have to park your brain when you come in the church. It's based on a historic fact that logical certainty is no longer possible when you can't be an eyewitness, though Paul was testifying that above 500 brethren who were eyewitnesses were still around in his day. We have to go at it like any other historic fact. The world has rejected it, just like these blackball people, because they say a resurrection, let's go with their blackball, resurrection cannot occur, therefore it didn't occur, any miracle didn't occur, and anybody that reports the miracle occurring is to be blackballed, because a miracle can't occur, therefore it didn't occur, therefore any report that it did is thus wrong, blackballed, because a miracle cannot occur, resurrection didn't occur because it's a miracle, anybody says it did is a false reporter, kick it out, blackball it, because a miracle cannot occur, therefore it didn't occur, anybody... That's arguing in a circle. That's why I drew it that way. You said everything you're going to say in your first word. Don't bore me with the rest of the circle. You've got a closed mind. I'm a skeptic. But I gained enough knowledge to know those that were asking me to kick my faith out didn't know the only Jesus that ever strode the stage of history. There's only one Jesus to be found in all the sources. One going around making such idiot claims, he's either a fraud or a nut. Have the guts to say it. Give the Jews credit. They recognized his claims were blasphemy. And to make them was to exalt yourself on parallel with God. But if the one who made them came out of the grave as he said he would and ascended off into the blue, saying he would return one day, I'm taking another look. And I therefore had to settle the resurrection. Can't give you all the proofs. Can't give you the frame of reference on which you have to build the case. Jesus lived. At least these guys recognize he lived. He was crucified at the hands of Pilate. I give them credit. They are pointing out that it wasn't the Jewish people that brought it about. Pilate crucified him, the Romans. But it's without much debate by any historian that it was the Jewish religious leaders who charged him, and they thought he was blasphemous, and I think with honest opinion on that subject. Not all the German nation is responsible for Hitler. But Hitler's an evil man, and his minions who supported him. It was the leadership whose very position was threatened, their self-righteousness punctured, that made the charge. And he died and was buried in a known tomb. And common sense should tell anybody that the Jewish leaders had more at stake than you and I have as an intellectual question 2,000 years later. It was bread, butter, and blood to them because they had charged him with blasphemy. If he came out of the tomb, their very livelihood and position was threatened. And that's why they quickly concocted the story that the disciples stole the body to explain the empty tomb because it was empty. There wasn't any grave in it. And today we still debate over two locations because it had no meaning until relics became important about the 5th century because there's no body in it. It was an empty tomb. If that resurrection occurred, I'm a believer. I had to settle it by looking at the facts. Now, I have never met a man, and I'm talking in potential to the whole world, anybody wants to can tune in. I've never met a man in my life, or a woman, academic, professor, teacher, friend, associates, casual acquaintances. I've never met a person that denies the resurrection of Jesus Christ, but what I can ask him 15 questions, and know he's never spent 15 hours in his life looking at the evidence. I'd be willing to bet big money, not one of these guys. I've looked at the evidence. I'd be willing to bet money they haven't read Sherlock's Trial of Witnesses, a classic, where a trial scene is staged, where all the witnesses are brought forth, and the resurrection claim is subjected to a courtroom test of evidence and witnesses on each side out of history. Robert Morrison, Who Moved the Stone? An attorney who set out to disprove the resurrection ended up writing the most convincing, popularized statement of the proof that convinced him of the resurrection. I don't respect people who deny it and haven't looked and act like they have. I can respect somebody who says the chance of it being true is so remote, I don't even want to look, but at least give me this. Don't run around saying Jesus is a good and wise teacher. Because he is not a good and wise teacher if he didn't raise from the dead, because only God can make the kind of claims he made. I had to settle it by looking at the evidence. Well, there are lots of theories. But all the theories explode because the disciples immediately begin preaching, empty tomb, resurrected Christ, by taking the food with him, they could touch him as Thomas did, and an ascension. All theories that have been propounded are attempts to explain the sincerity of the preachers and the fact of an empty tomb. What they have not taken into account in the theories is the ascension message. And the full fabric of the message of partaking of food with Christ, cooking on the shore of Galilee, the personal encounters, Thomas, the offer to let him touch the wounds, the story that was preached that revolutionized the first century world was preached by his disciples of a living, resurrected Christ who was with them, partook of food with them, for 40 days, again and again was seen, and then they watched him sail off in the blue. Not in a chariot, as Elijah did. And there's some who try to say that's a throwback to that Elijah picture to try to put it on Christ. No, Elijah got a chariot. Jesus, in his own being, whatever it was, is claimed to have ascended. Well, now look. If I can believe the resurrection, it took me a while. I know I'm more space than what we call reality. And I'm a mass or foci of moving elements, neutrons, protons, atoms. We've gained the ability to split them now and get an explosion. But if Jesus was what he claimed to be, then molecular displacement's nothing to him. He can go through without the explosion. come out on the other side. He can miss the atoms and not split them. If you accept the resurrection, you're already off into the miraculous element. The invisible is not strange to me. I happen to be a believer in that strange experiment called the Philadelphia experiment that has been swept under the rug with an attempt so-called to just be invisible to radar. And it went beyond that. If God exists, and if He spoke and nothing became everything, which is the Old Testament claim, then molecular displacement is in His hands. I would guess the day will come. We'll know a great deal more about getting through the molecules without an explosion. He's the Creator. If I can believe He came through that rock, through those grave clothes, through a locked door, and sailed off in the blue, man, you can have your opinion. I'm going to listen to Jesus. And that's been the basis of my faith these many years, because I looked for 3.5 years. And here's what convinced me. I went through the facts that had to be taken for granted. They're a lot easier to prove than the resurrection. I usually do that in this message. I went through all the theories and showed how they did not encompass the totality of the message that was preached, and they didn't even embrace the ascension, because there's only two theories. It's all based on the credibility of the witnesses. Like the O.J. Simpson trial. Who's going to believe? Either the disciples and the tellers of this story lied and knew they were lying. They had bet on the wrong person. He disappointed them. They're now going to take the heat off of Judas, saying Judas didn't do what he did either. Well, I've never been too hard on Judas. At least he had the conscience to hang himself. I think that he thought he would force Jesus to declare his kingdom. And then it backfired. And Jesus is crucified and he hangs himself. But Jesus had disciples totally shaken and fleeing in fear after the crucifixion. Now, they either waited 7 weeks, figured out how can we save face, we bet on the wrong person, and they made up this whole story, or, as shocked as you and I would be, thinking it was over, and to their surprise, he has risen, and he says, now you're going to be my witness, but don't do it until 7 weeks later, that they might begin on the Feast of Pentecost. And they didn't even ask the question, will this hurt or help the story? They did what he said. They were simple, honest reporters. Or, they were liars. Nothing in between. All theories, starting with the first one the Jews propounded, that they stole the body, reduced down to their lying or their honest reporters. And it took me almost 2 years, 2.5 years, to reduce the issue down to this. He can't be good and wise, and everybody wants to call him that because of the influence of his life. But to be good and wise, you've got to be what he claimed to be. Verification, the resurrection. You're then a push to a startling alternate there. The resurrection is basically revolving around the testimony of these witnesses, his apostles. They either lied and made it up to save face, or honest reporters. Four reasons why I don't think they lie. Internal evidence, I'll only use one. All scholars agree, these people want to take it out, but they agree Mark wrote his gospel to either the Romans or the Egyptians. He was martyred in Alexandria, became bishop there, dragged to death in the streets of Alexandria for his testimony. But he wrote his gospel for Gentiles, not for Jews. Now, if he were writing to Jews, he could pick no more messianic term than Son of Man. When you and I, if you don't have a history of the book of Enoch and the book of Daniel, and the Old Testament, the apocryphal book of Enoch, and the canonized book of Daniel, you use the word Son of Man, you're going to think of humanity. But to a Jewish listener, schooled in the apocryphal literature, the apocalyptic views they had of the coming Messiah, the words in Daniel and Enoch having more pregnant meaning of divinity as Messiah than any other phrase was Son of Man. Daniel sees, Enoch sees Son of Man coming in the clouds of glory to set up his kingdom. So speaking to Jews, that has a divine connotation. But if you're writing to Gentiles who've never read those books, and you're trying to prove that Jesus is Son of God, and you're a liar, well, then don't have him call himself Son of Man. If you're a liar, you don't care what you put in it. So you're writing to Gentiles who know nothing of the Hebrew apocalyptic literature about Son of Man, Messiah. Then don't have Jesus refer to himself as Son of Man. Have him refer to himself as Son of God. You're lying anyway, so what matters what you do? Go read Mark. Shortest of the Gospels, more than any one of the four Gospels, he has Jesus referring to himself, Son of Man. Indirect, inside indices of honest reporting. If he's a liar and knows he's lying, why hurt his case by having Jesus say, Son of Man? You're not going to be true to what he said. You're making up a lie. Hosts of such evidences are there. I'll use one more. They were in the wilderness. The multitude was there before Jesus fed them. He asked Philip where to buy bread. That's in Luke. You wonder, why did he ask Philip? You have to go to John, written in another place, without benefit of Luke in front of him. John tells us Philip was born at Bethsaida. Another gospel record tells us that the miracle location was Bethsaida. You put them all together, they're being honest and true to the facts. Philip was the logical one to ask. That was his hometown. All through these gospel records, they don't sound like liars. They say things that hurt their case. They act like people who don't know that others are cooperating in a conspiracy to tell a lie. Second, charismatic and cataclysmic changes in their personality. Peter, always unstable. Jesus wants to wash his feet. No, you're not washing my feet. Well, if I don't wash your feet, you can't go in the kingdom. Wash me all over. Always the extremists. Somebody's going to deny me. Not me, Peter says. They can kill me. He's not satisfied to say, I won't deny you. They can kill me. I won't do it. Flees in fear when the crowd was there, other disciples with him. After the resurrection, some event in between changed him. Because this unstable, cowardly person is suddenly standing unshakable in front of a mocking mob and continues that stance in the very city where he denied his Lord previously and cursed to illustrate his identity with those enemies of Christ at whose fire he was warming himself. A total change from an unstable person to the rock, the symbol of which is the foundation of the church. John, brother of James, not James, the so-called brother of Jesus, the two sons of thunder, they were called. If anybody opposed them, they'd call fire down from heaven on them. They came to Jesus wanting the best seat in the kingdom. No, they didn't. They sent their mother to do it, which is worse. Not very attractive, self-centered, selfish, high-tempered sons of thunder seeking the best seat in the kingdom. Something happened. Everybody agrees. John's is the gospel of love. Everybody agrees that more than anyone else, John became the gentleman, the one who was constantly demonstrating love, give rather than take. Thomas, doubter, consistently. Jesus faces a dangerous journey. He says, let us go that we may die with him. Courage, love, but expected Jesus to be killed. A very human view. Jesus is talking about going away to prepare mansions. Whither I go, you know, the way you know. Everybody else is happy over the mansions. Thomas says, we don't know where you're going. How can we know the way? He's a realist. Someone has said, if I didn't believe in Jesus, I'd worship the fabricators. It's almost supernatural, the way they weave these character traits in different books. And then, as though a meat cleaver, invisible wall drops down. They change. Peter became stable. John, from selfish, conniving, high-tempered, to the apostle of love. Thomas, the consistent doubter. Who's doubting when the testimony of the resurrection comes? Same guy, Thomas. I will not believe, lest I put my hand in the print of the nails and thrust it into his side. Consistently the doubter. Jesus appears after the resurrection. Behold my hands, my side. He offered to submit to the very test Thomas wanted. Not by accident, in my judgment, does Thomas become the apostle, piercing the Himalayas, to take the gospel to the most philosophic, religious speaking, philosophic realm in the world, where the Vedanta faith had flowered, and out of it all the streams of Buddhism, and those mystics of India who've questioned reality and the solutions and problems related to it down through the centuries. Thomas, the doubter, with his faith secure, having said when Jesus offered to submit, my Lord and my God, never wavering again, he becomes a rock of faith that can go to the toughest area philosophically to take the gospel. Cataclysmic change from instability to stability. Self-centered, high-tempered existence to love-centered. Doubt to faith. Positive change. I believe a lie can change someone, but not for the better, usually. These men are cataclysmically changed for the better. Third, you don't suffer what they suffered for a lie. Peter crucified upside down. Bartholomew in your land. Flayed to death. Skinned alive with a whip. Thomas, pierced with a Brahmin sword near Madras, India. Andrew, crucified on the crisscross cross from which it gets its name. Every single one of them, Mark, dragged to death in the streets of Alexandria. Luke, hanged by idolatrous priests in Greece. Every single one of them paid a martyr's death for the lie. What did that do to get out of it? That's repeated over and over in Acts. His quick testifying of the resurrection. And St. Thomas, fourth, great proof of the resurrection, they suffered this martyrdom alone. I could conceive, J.U.B., Apostle Peter, okay? You're over in Rome. You're going to be, for what I'm going to illustrate, you be the Apostle Peter. Dr. Folker, you be Thomas in India. And I'll be Bartholomew. If we assume this is a lie, then we don't have any thoughts of where the other guy is. We've separated now. I'm in Armenia. We don't have satellite. We don't have phone. We don't have television. We don't have newspaper. We don't have CNN. We don't have Baghdad Pete. You don't know what I'm doing. You're in Rome. I'm in Armenia. You don't know what I'm doing. You're across the Himalayas. No radio, no telephone, no nothing. We have no expectancy of ever seeing each other again. They're going to skin me alive with a whip. Now, I could believe that if the three of us stayed together and we agreed to tell a lie, you break ranks. You not only have to deal with everybody else, you got to deal with me. If I break ranks, I got to deal with you. There's something about that group pressure If we agree in a conspiracy to unite and tell a lie to save face for following the wrong leader, I can maybe concede, keep us together, we might suffer great persecution and not break rank because there's that horizontal pressure. But man, I'm by myself in Bartholomew. I'm Bartholomew by myself in Armenia. Being skinned alive with a whip ain't the way I figured this would turn out. All I got to say is, hey, I was pressured by those two geezers, Peter and Thomas, to cooperate with them in this life's lie. It ain't so. I lied. Let me off this stake. I lied. What do you want me to sign? I catch the next boat, come sailing into Rome. Hi, Jay. How's the story going? You're doing good? Wait till I tell you the way I kept them spellbound over in Armenia. You're handling your end, okay? I don't want to even go over the Himalayas to you. The point is, who would know? I just back out, renege on the story, and save my skin, literally in that case. And I'm on the next boat to some new victimizing area where I can tell this story for my own gain. St. Thomas Aquinas put his finger on it years ago. It's psychologically inconceivable that all of these cooperating in a lie would die alone, suffering horrible death for the story without one breaking rank. Just psychologically inconceivable. One of this number telling this story would break rank. Find one. That'd be a good job for these academics. Find one. Anywhere that retracted on the story. Dying alone in far-flung corners of the then-known world. Nowhere for 2,000 years can they find a single person who retracted the story. I remember Larry Thomas, who I respect beyond belief, my major prof at Stanford on my doctoral program. I finished with this, and he said to me, Gene, I'm convinced those disciples believed what they were telling. So some one of your other facts must be wrong. They just don't want to accept the miracle. Well, the other facts are easy compared to proving the resurrection. He came out of that grave. That makes him different. Anyone else who ever strode the stage of history. That gives credence to the most basic claim of the church, if they just remember it, that God moved out of the unknown, struck a tent in human flesh called Jesus of Nazareth, and brought God into the street where ordinary people lived. He was a friend of sinners. He was criticized for that. He was called a wine-bibber and a glutton. The common people heard him gladly. The Pharisees wrapped their self-righteous robes about themselves and said concerning the publican, I thank my God, I'm not like him. Jesus said, the publican gets his prayers answered. He goes to Jericho, invites the biggest sinner in town to lunch. I'm hooked on Jesus, not the traditions of the church. He came out of the tomb, not the deacon board. He died for my sins and covered me completely, that I might have new life and be accepted by God because I trust Him, not because I'm perfect. He's become a challenge of a lifetime to come to know this person who was God incarnate, walking ordinary streets and bringing God's life down where people live. A bruised reed will He not break. Smoking flax will He not quench. He doesn't step on us when we're down. He tells the stories of the father who runs to greet the prodigal, who comes out of his insanity, if you read the Greek, and runs back to his father's house willing to be a servant. Jesus pictures God as a father who runs to kiss him, eager to give him another chance. That's why this church is built on preaching the message of forgiveness and grace and unmerited favor, because God deigned to step through his Son from the throne of glory and stoop down, as the Hebrew letter has it. The Greek word has three parts to it. Epilambano, to reach, and to reach with an intent to help, and to take hold of in a rescuing act. God, for my trust, gives me a presence. I don't have any trouble now going around. I mean, I saw a movie once where John Wayne kept his sanity in a cell, some war movie, by talking to a bird that he imagined was on his shoulder. Well, I got more than a bird. I got the unseen presence of that same one who moved into a tent of human flesh called Jesus of Nazareth, willing to camp by my side, and promises never to leave me nor forsake me. And as I trust him, no matter what the problem, he takes my trust and gives me everything else, covers all my weaknesses. And as I've said, and I now want to say it every week to this congregation, what do you want from your lover? What do you want from your friend? What do you want from your children, husband, wife? You want perfection, or you want trust? And your answer tells you the key that has been lost in both the Hebrew and the Christian tradition. Ever since Adam and Eve believed the devil, whether you take that as a myth or reality, the truth is they believed the devil and they distrusted God. And from that day until now, he's been looking for someone to trust him. You're as close to God's heart as you'll ever be when you answer the question I just asked you. And this church stands and takes the message to the world. We're saved by faith, not by works. I frustrate not the grace of God, for if righteousness came by my works, then Christ is dead in vain. Faith gets us in. And as you reach through the cloud and the morass of circumstance and trust to God who revealed himself in Christ as loving you enough to give his best in your place, he'll take you as you are, and for that trust, he'll treat you as though you're as righteous as Jesus. It's trust, faith, that makes the difference, not self-righteous works. And for 20 years and 6 years in this building, that's been our message, and for the next 20 years, and forever, if I can stay here that long, I'd like to, but I'm sure I won't, that's going to be the